Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. It is Wednesday, first hour of our program, time for Middays with Mark, Congressman Mark Pocan, the co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, the U.S. Congressman representing the 2nd District of Wisconsin. You can tweet him at Rep, as in Representative, R-E-P, Rep Mark Pocan. And his website, pocan.house.gov, pocan.house.gov. Congressman, welcome. Oh, and just for all of our listeners, Congressman Pocan, Middays with Mark means he's here for the whole hour taking your calls on pretty much any topic you want. Congressman, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom. Glad to be here.
So I understand Marco Rubio has done a small open mouth insert foot thing. It doesn't seem to be getting anywhere near the publicity. I think it should.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Marco Rubio made the mistake of saying something honestly, and it got a lot of play around the GOP tech scam bill, and now he's trying to walk it back, and they're very unhappy with him and others who don't say that somehow this is the economic boon for the middle class, because everyone knows it's not, and never was intended to be. There's a little bit in there for working families. In 10 years, it completely goes away. They keep the corporate tax cuts. They keep the tax cuts for the wealthy, and 83% of the money in 10 years will go to the top 1 or 2% of people. And he said that's the deal. Basically, it's not going to help the middle class. And, you know, this is the only thing they have done this session. They're trying to point to something, and they want to, of course, hide the fact that this was really done for their donors, as other Republicans previously have said. But, you know, once again, Marco Rubio said that, now trying to reel it back. But the best part, Tom, is, again, people are way smarter than politicians think they are. They've already understood that this is not something going to benefit them. And in fact, just was a poll, small business owners are saying this isn't going to benefit them either. This is just for the ultra-wealthy.
Yeah, yeah, remarkable. And the fact that Marco Rubio would own up to that, is he walking back that comment now?
Yeah, he is. He
of course.
Of course. He was candid and honest. Yeah. He can't be a Republican and be candid and honest.
Yeah. And meanwhile, next week we've got a big net neutrality event happening, and it's part of it is going to be happening where you live and work. I mean, or you know, in Congress. Tell us about that.
So there's a big day of action a week from today, actually, because today's the 2nd, right? Yeah, so a week from today, the 9th, in the Senate, Senator Markey of Massachusetts and others are trying to push a vote to overturn the decision by the FCC on net neutrality, which essentially is keeping the internet to stay free and open. You know, President Obama, under his tenure, the FCC put some guidelines in that said you can't block websites, you can't slow down websites, you can't charge companies for access to internet fast lanes. In other words, local businesses would have the same access as Amazon. Of course, Donald Trump changed that with his FCC, and now all sorts of folks are affected, and the Senate actually is within one vote of being able to overturn that. So there's a lot of action around that. 23 attorney generals in states across the country have sued over this, but we need to be even more active. You know, in my office, Tom, I think before I've reported 6,400 people contacted me in the first 3 weeks, and no one against it. I have updated numbers now. 12,983 people against the decision. No one for it.
Literally, no one has called your office and said, I'm all in favor of Comcast not having net neutrality, but being able to read all my emails.
No executive, no Verizon executive, no Comcast executive, because those would be the only people who are going to benefit, right?
Yeah.
No one. So it's such a skewed issue. This is something we really should be able to win on. So I think, you know, whatever activities people can do in the U.S. Senate between now and June when a vote's going to happen, we're really close on this one.
Yeah. And I also have a question about the DOJ and this apparent cover-up by Congress, Nunes, and his buddies. But in all probability, one of our listeners will call and ask that question. And the lines are already halfway full here. So shall we pick up some phone calls? Is that all right with you?
Sure. Yeah, let's
all
do
right,
that.
Great.
Yeah, that'd be great.
David in Greenfield, California. You're on the air with Congressman Pocia.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I believe in our country's checks and balances. Donald Trump seems ready to end the Iran nuclear treaty. Would Trump only need to use the AUMF to start another never-ending war in the Middle East, or would Trump need to get congressional approval to start a war in Iran?
Good question.
Great question, David. It's kind of two issues, and while they may relate, let me address each of them quickly. One, I think he has until May 12th on the Iran agreement. I was one of our whip team on the Democratic side trying to make sure we got that in place. We don't want more nuclear weapons, period. And I think it would be very unwise of the president to not continue that agreement. If he does, Iran very likely could go about trying to put together nuclear weapons, and then we're going to have all sorts of other problems. So that's one. Secondly, right now, every president since 9/11 has, in my opinion, probably overused the authority under the former AUMF that was created allows them to go into other interventions around the world. The Constitution says it's up to Congress, except for self-defense, because of this very loose AUMF that was done post 9/11. Every president had used it, and each time, I think, a little more broader than they should. And while there's some conversations in the Senate of having a new one, because we've had this conversation in the House, what they do could be still open-ended, and that would be a terrible idea. And then that would give the president some hook, some reason to do something, whether it be Iran or anywhere, and you wouldn't have the constitutionally required authority coming from Congress. So they're related, but they're two separate issues that we're dealing with.
It seems to me, Congressman, that the only times that we've actually declared war have been when we went to war against white Europeans, when we bombed the crap out of brown people, whether it's in Central America, whether it's in Grenada, whether it's in Africa, where it's in the Middle East, whether it's in Asia, Vietnam, Korea, 1950. We seem not to need a declaration of war. Am I seeing something here that's not there?
But you're seeing a pattern by our interventions. I would just argue, the people who wrote our Constitution clearly wanted it to be the power of Congress, and
yeah.
I'm guessing it's because we also are the closest to the people. And every time you do something that takes it away from us, sometimes members of Congress like that, right, because they don't want to have to make a tough decision. So definitely that is a part of the problem, Tom. But also every president, especially since this last AUMF, has used it pretty broadly to just ignore Congress because, let's face it, we are more dysfunctional these days, and they're trying to do something quicker and easier. But the Constitution wasn't written to be quick and easy. It was done to be very thorough, and I think that's why we're trying to get a new AUMF that brings us back to the power happening within Congress except for self-defense.
Right. Russ in Hickory Hills, Illinois. Russ, thanks for listening to WCPT. You're on the air with Congressman Hocan.
Yeah, Mr. Pocan, maybe I'm overstating this. Did you ever think when you got in Congress that the United States could be more isolated than North Korea? I mean, when he pulls out of the Iran deal, let's be honest, Europeans are going to turn their back. He's pulled out of the climate. He's pulled out of TPP, NAFTA. Don't forget, North Korea was told by China they'll bury him if they use their nukes. I mean, it's just like this Republican Party is just out to end any kind of relationship with anybody. Am I overstating it? Because these guys don't want nobody to be their friends, it seems like.
I think, Russ, you're bringing up a really great observational point with this president. It's one thing to be America first. It's another thing to be America only. And I think, this isolationism this president's putting out there isn't done based on things like keeping jobs in America and having good quality jobs worldwide, having it on good standards, it's done out of xenophobia, right? Much of what he's doing is because, you know, as Tom was saying earlier, our problem with some wars, if there's people who have different colored skins in some areas, you know, this president has been far quicker to do things that make us even more isolationist. And I guess I never thought that in a global era where everything is being more connected globally, that we would be in a retreat as much as we are with this president for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah, certainly seems so. We're talking with Congressman Mark Pocan. It's Middays with Mark here on the Tom Hartman Program. Every Wednesday, the first hour, he comes on and answers your questions for the hour. And Congressman Pocan, by the way, is the co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. He represents the 2nd District of Wisconsin of the U.S. House of Representatives. His website, pocan.house.gov, and you can tweet him at Rep. Mark Pocan. Give him a shout and say hi. We'll be right back. It's Talk Media for the Sane Among Us, the Tom Hartman Program, our Middays with Mark, our Congressman Mark Pocan taking your calls for the hour. Dan in Omaha, Nebraska, you are on the air with Congressman Pocan.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Congressman Pocan, I've got a problem here. I took American history in high school. I took American history in college. And when it comes to discussing FDR and the regulatory people, one of them was the FCC, and the FCC was a regulatory commission to take care of the industry, not to, you know, help them, but to help the public. And as I see this net neutrality being threatened, I see that all of a sudden, instead of the FCC regulating the industries, it's now regulating us, telling us how much of the net we can have now. And I wonder why people haven't thought of that. I mean, it is a regulatory organization. It's not something that helps the industry. Can you explain that?
Yeah, you know, this is a classic example of the elections have consequences model, right? Donald Trump becoming president after Barack Obama. Barack Obama used the FCC in an effective way to help protect a free and open internet and making sure companies couldn't block websites and charge extra for fast lanes and all the rest to keep it open to everyone. And then Donald Trump comes in and puts his own appointments in and completely changes that on behalf of the industry. And it's such a small industry, as I explained. I had 12,983 people in my district opposed the FCC change, and no one was for it. So this is not a public even debate. This is a debate among which big telecom company is going to make more money as they abuse this rule. So, you know, recently Commissioner Clyburn, who had been there for a number of years, she's going to be stepping down, and we had a great conversation with her at the Progressive Caucus on this, and luckily she's going to be a voice on the outside now with a lot of good inside information. But we need to make this be an agency that works for the people. Again, it's certainly not doing that now.
Yeah, I'm in. Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. You're on the air with Congressman Pocan.
Hi, Dr. Tom. Congressman Pocan, I was watching the dog and pony show that Netanyahu, however you say his name, was putting on for Trump. And then I'm sitting there watching Trump in front of West Point, and he can't even name all the branches of the military. He can't. I guess he's never heard of the Merchant Marines. And I'm sitting there watching this, and I'm wondering, do we hear the beating of war drums? And is Congress going to go along with this? How many people in Congress and the Senate have dual citizenship, and where does the loyalty lie?
Are you talking specifically in the Middle East, or Norma, or more broadly?
I'm talking about, are we going to obey Israel and attack Iran, or are we going to obey Saudi Arabia and attack Iran?
Gotcha. And what you just mentioned, I mean, is part of the problem, right? Saudi Arabia has been very close to Donald Trump, both for his business dealings before being to Congress, and now Israel Netanyahu, who is having his own problems in his country, has been close to President Trump for whatever reasons. And I would also argue Donald Trump doesn't have a clue of what's going on in the Middle East. He put his son-in-law in charge, but that certainly hasn't fixed anything. So, you know, a lot of us have concerns. I mean, on this Iran deal, if we wind up taking the rhetoric from Netanyahu, not from the Israeli people, but from Netanyahu, and do something to change that agreement, we are setting ourselves up to either have nuclear weapons in the region or having ourselves slip into further altercations. And I would also argue, if I can, Tom, just a little leniency on this. You know, we need to do stand up more about Gaza than we have. You know, recently, three of us who were denied access 2 years ago this month wrote to the Israel ambassador and asked for permission. We want to go into Gaza. The last person and I know of in Congress that was there was Keith Ellison. It's been at least 6 or so years. To imagine there's 2 million people that no member of Congress, with all the money that we put into the Middle East and into Israel, aren't allowed to go in and see the conditions for ourselves, to see how the money is working or not working, is pretty outrageous. And I think we need to have much better, smarter thinking about how we deal with the Middle East, and Donald Trump has not shown any indication to do that.
Charles, in Augusta County, Virginia, you are on the air with Congressman Pocan.
Yes, Congressman Pocan. I'm Charles Smith. I'm over in the Shenandoah Valley. I install satellite dishes and TV antennas for people in rural areas to get TV, internet, so forth. Right now, I just learned about this FCC repack that's going on, where they're taking all of the RF frequencies above 36 and giving those to the telephone industry, the cell phone industry. So is this an effort by the FCC to get rid of off-air TV, or everyone's going to go to satellite or cable?
I know the answer to that.
You do? Yeah. Go ahead, Tom, and then I can offer something extra on that, but I don't have a specific answer to his question.
Yeah, I'm on the board of Vocal, which is a charity that, you know, we distribute money to groups for good works, and we make our money from leasing bandwidth to Sprint. So I'm real familiar with this, I think. There's a fair amount of TV frequencies that broadly are not being used for TV. And a lot of this is in the educational broadcast band area. And the companies or organizations that hold that frequency, like the Catholic Church is a big one in Chicago, for example, and our group, sublease that bandwidth to telephone companies that they're using and that's how we get the money to distribute to progressive groups. There's a push to basically cut all those groups out of the loop and simply redefine that bandwidth as telephone bandwidth rather than TV bandwidth. So that's what I know about it.
And let me ask this if I can, Tom. So there's also been a push to take some of the low wave bandwidth and try to get it to rural internet access and to inner city internet access. Is this a separate move than that?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a whole separate thing.
Yeah, because the other move that, you know, we're looking at, Charles, also is, and I'm in the school of throw all the spaghetti on the wall and let's see what sticks when it is trying to get broadband out there, is they're looking at some of the low wave emergency channel and other stuff that's not even used that you can actually now provide in some rural areas much more affordably broadband, high-speed broadband. Right. And Microsoft is one of the companies that's in some development on that. They admit their goal is just to get everyone in the cloud. My goal is to make sure that everyone in my rural areas has the same access to do their homework and run a business as the people in my urban areas. And that's not, I don't think, part of the repackaging, although there is an effort to try to get some changes on that may take official recognition.
Yeah, there is no effort, though, to take down over-the-air TV. There is space between the channels on over-the-air TV where there's discussion about using that space. And there's a big space between channels, I think it's 6 and 7, that has been used for a long time. Ham radio operators, for example, that's the 6-meter band. But anyhow, back to our callers here. Patricia in Portage, Wisconsin, you're on the air with Congressman Pocan.
Hi. I write a living wildlife column for the Capital Times newspaper out of Madison, and I am lobbying you to put ad in biodiversity destruction in with climate change as on the progressive Democratic platform, because people, part of the responsibility of legislators is to lead on issues that the public doesn't understand are critical to their survival. And even the Vatican met in February 2017 and pronounced biodiversity destruction, 2/3 of wildlife gone in 50 years, is a panic on this planet. And it's not being addressed. And I think the Democratic Party has to be bold, and part of that boldness is leading on issues that the public is virtually ignorant that are important. And part of that is taking our federal and state agencies away from hunting and trapping licenses, funding them, and putting them into general public funding.
Thoughts, Congressman?
Yeah, so Patricia, I think the point you make is good, and if it's not implied, at least it's implied, if not fully stated, that obviously biodiversity is an important part when you talk about climate change. So I appreciate the words you're saying, and maybe we just have to be making sure that it's fully included in as we talk about it, because the impacts of losing biodiversity is more than just losing species, but it's all the connectivity and what that means in many other areas and what that means. So it should be something that's ranked higher, and I certainly appreciate what you're saying.
Tim in Utica, Michigan. Hey, Tim, thanks for listening to SiriusXM. You're on the air with Congressman Pocan.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. I was just wondering if the congressman, during one of their discussions on the floor, would ask his fellow congressmen, primarily Jim Jordan and Mark Meadows, why are they supporting the Russians over our Justice Department and our FBI?
You're talking about the proposed impeachment of Deputy AG Rod Rosenstein?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, not only that, they've been going after Mueller and the entire FBI hierarchy,
sure.
Saying that, you know, there's the deep-seated black commission or whatever they call it.
Yeah. Well, let's get Congressman Pocan's thoughts.
Clearly, Ronald Reagan would be turning over in his grave, I think, you know, to see people who call themselves conservatives acting like there are. I mean, I think they use this as a means to their ends. You know, the ends are that they're trying to kind of dismantle the federal government, and they're just going to take advantage of any opportunity to do so. And if they think they have their hooks in Donald Trump to get him to do some things, and he's going to be slowed down by this investigation, they're going to try to slow down or get rid of the investigation. So it's not even that they care, which is really sad, right, that another country might be interfering with your elections at the level they are, and yet what they're really concerned about is dismantling the federal government, and they'll do anything to get there. And that's just a sad statement of where their party is today, Tim.
Yeah, party above country, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is what it seems like we've come to, which is really, really tragic. Congressman Mark Pocan, it's Middays with Mark on the Tom Hartman Program, taking your calls for the hour. He represents the 2nd District of Wisconsin. His website is pocan.house.gov. He's the co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. And you can tweet him at Rep. Mark Pocan, as in representative Rep. Mark Pocan.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And all of that is spelled just as you might think, REPMARKPOCAN. Drop him a hello on Twitter. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. There's a real interesting conversation that's been started by a guy named Robin Hanson. Robin works at the Mercantor, or whatever you call it, center at George Mason University, the group that is largely funded by the Koch brothers. He's a libertarian economist, and he raises the question. I'm reading his blog here. His most recent post, this is from yesterday, is titled A Pullable Thread of the Social Fabric. And he mentions the incels, the involuntarily celibate people. And he compares them to liberals. And he says, while the two groups focus on different axes of inequality, they each organize to induce envy and identity with the deprived status. And what he's talking about with regard to liberals is, hey, there's poor people, and they're not getting any money from our rich people, and therefore we need to take money from rich people in the form of taxes, which Robin Hanson considers violence, as do the Koch brothers, and give that to poor people so that they can have health care and housing and things. So anyhow, back to what he says. They each organize to induce envy and identity with a deprived status, to hint at the possibility of violence. Obviously, the possibility of violence in the case of liberals is, if you don't give us your taxes, we will put you in prison. And to lobby for, quote, redistribution. And then he goes on to say that this is proof that policy can, in fact, influence sexual inequality. He's talking about ancient societies. He says most ancient societies had policies that influenced the redistribution of sex. And this is proof that policy can, in fact, influence sexual inequality. Many people cared about this kind of inequality. You may think you have good moral arguments why such policies are bad, but as with income inequality, you should at least admit that people who feel envious and empowered to push policy may not be much influenced by your moral arguments. His argument specifically, and I've got another one of his blog posts here where he lays it out, is that, you know, basically unattractive women should be forced to have sex with unattractive men. And one proposed policy, this is not specifically from Robin Hanson, he's blogging about it, this is from Josh Marshall. This anger at women from these involuntarily celibate men who believe they are sexually unappealing and as they are, and yet nonetheless refuse to have sex with them, the women refuse to have sex with them. One proposed policy is to have the government assign each person a sexual market value. That's what Hanson is talking about here. People can only have sex with people of their own value. And for women, the more partners they have, the further their market value number falls, sort of big data of slut shaming. And the more sexually active a woman becomes, the greater an obligation she incurs to have sex with the least sexually appealing men. And the only way to up her score, in other words, to get out of having sex with these unattractive men, is through exercise to make herself more attractive. So he says alternating bouts of servicing sexually enraged losers and logging nonstop hours at the gym. This is the idea for women, apparently. And Professor Hanson here talking about this at some length. He's got another blog post. It's called Food Versus Sex Charity. And he says, before I go into all this, let's get another libertarian on to see what they think of this. Charles Sauer, libertarian economist, president of the Market Institute, author of the new book, Profit Motive, What Drives the Things We Do. Marketinstitute.org is the website. You can tweet him at Charles Sauer, S-A-U-E-R. Charles, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
So Professor Hanson is arguing that it is possible to have a marketplace for sex, defined by government policy, and doesn't come right out and embrace it, but certainly embraces the concept and says that it has been the case in previous societies. Really?
Well, this is just academic exploration, and the worst part here is the pushback on this has been the left's renunciation or moving away from academic freedom to think. And if you read these blog posts, you won't come away with most of the talking points you just came away with. First off, the title of the blog is called Overcoming Bias. It's an economic blog. And in this case in particular, he's talking about the horrific incident in Toronto where an incel mowed down people on a sidewalk. And this story came to light. And so it's
and in San Bernardino.
I think it's something that he mentions in his blog, but he hadn't heard of this group before. And if you look into it, the incels are the ones that proposed providing some sort of a numeric number for attractiveness. And so he looked into this because if you read his blog, I mean, I think it makes perfect sense that the incels' argument and the liberals' argument for income equality seem to be the same. If a business is successful, a liberal moves them down on their chain and they have to hire more people in a liberal's mind. That's the same argument that incel makes. It's the same argument I've heard you make on here before.
So here's what Robin Hanson says. This is from his blog post. This is his blog titled Food Versus Sex Charity. And he talks about, the problem of a man wanting food because he's hungry versus a man wanting sex because he's horny. And he says, even then, we treat food and sex differently. When we give food aid, we don't just give rice and beans to keep people from starving. We give them enough food to have a moderately tasty diet. He's talking about food stamps. He says, we do nothing remotely similar to sex. For me, the obvious answer is that our concern about inequality is not very general. Compared to inequality and access to foods, to food, humans are just not that concerned about sexual inequality, especially for men, poor men. Presumably for our ancestors, the gene pool of a tribe could benefit from equalizing food in ways that it could not benefit by equalizing sex. Is that the counter argument that he's making here?
No, this is a professor thinking out loud on his blog. You're allowed to push back. And he's also a type of professor that he has books out there. He's a futurist. He thinks in the future. I've actually hosted him at my group Prosperity Caucus several different times, and he's one of the top experts on what's going to happen when AI evolves and becomes a more a part of our society. What does that economy look like? Robin Hanser is a thinker. So he hears what's going on in the public. He hears the conversation and he takes that and moves it into an economic argument so that we can actually think about it in some sort of way where we might be able to rationally talk about it.
Okay.
Inequality, you can't talk about it rationally.
He also talks about one possible solution to this is something he calls gentle rape. He says, imagine a woman who was drugged into unconsciousness and then gently raped so that she suffered no noticeable physical harm nor any memory of the event. And the rapist tried to keep the event secret. He says, most farming societies did this. A colleague of mine suggests this is gender bias, pure and simple. Women seem feminist and male chivalrous, but right, by railing against rape, no one looks good complaining about cuckoldry. He seems to be very upset about women who have affairs. He says, we all know, and I'm quoting him now, we all know that women tend to be more expressive about their complaints. You can't beat them for wailing and gnashing of teeth. Really?
Yep. So here's
the deal. Do you endorse that?
If you ask Robin Hanson if he agrees with the way that you just portrayed those comments, he's going to say no. He was talking about what's happened in the past. He was proposing economic ideas versus what's happening. Let's compare this to the way that the liberals are. We have Joy Reid from MSNBC, who just claimed a hack in the fact that she didn't say actual hate speech against somebody and ran away with it. Again, this is a professor. I don't agree with the policy solutions he's talking about. I think they're awful.
I don't think he's claiming a hack. So direct question, Charles. What is the libertarian solution to the problem of these unattractive young men who are willing to kill people over their outrage that they're not getting sex?
Psychologist. There's no market solution to this, unless maybe you could allow and legalize prostitution. That might be the libertarian.
But then these guys, I mean, you know, prostitution is widely available. It was certainly available to the San Bernardino shooter and to the Toronto car killer. But they might argue that it is demeaning to them to have to pay for sex, or that they simply can't afford to pay for sex.
But look, let's look at the way that you're framing this question. The way that you're framing this question is ignoring the fact that Robin Hanson is a professor. He's an academic that talks about economic policy. What you're trying to do is shut an academic down from talking about policy. That's
no, I'm trying to discuss the policy
doing.
That he brought up. You have not heard me use one adjective to describe Robin Hanson. I'm serious.
You're portraying his thoughts, and you have been saying when you're quoting him, you've been light when you're quoting the incels versus him. But the fact is that an academic should be able to put thoughts out on the internet as long as they don't act on them. He's not up on – Robin Hanson isn't somebody up on Capitol Hill pursuing these policies. He's somebody that is looking
we have a very real problem with now we've had two people on this continent who have murdered a bunch of people, principally women, because they are upset that they are involuntarily celibate, that they are still virgins, and they're no woman has run up to them and say, hey, let's have sex. And they're very upset about this. I guess neither one of us, Charles, have a solution to this problem. Charles Sauer, libertarian economist and president of the Market Institute, his new book, Profit Motive, marketinstitute.org. Thanks, Charles.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back. You got a solution to this problem? Or maybe we just need to, like, take seriously putting these guys in prison.
Hey, I've got to tell you about the world's best chair. Most of us spend over 2,000 hours a year sitting in our office chairs, and if you have back problems or trouble concentrating throughout the day, there's a simple reason. You're sitting in the wrong chair. Take your chair, your style, and your productivity to the next level with an X chair. The X chair's unique anthropomorphic design and dynamic variable lumbar support cradle your body in a way you need to feel to believe. And a more comfortable posture means better concentration and much higher productivity. In fact, if you're a business owner, there's no better way to reward your top performers than giving them an X chair. And the X chair's sleek, modern style will upgrade the entire look of your office. Give yourself and your staff the gift that pays dividends 5 days a week, year round. Feel and see the X chair difference by going to xchairtom.com right now. That's the letter X, chair, Tom, T-H-O-M, .com or call 1-844-4X-CHAIR. If you're not truly thrilled by the look and feel after 30 days, return it for a full refund. Order today and save $100 and get free shipping. If you go to xchairtom.com right now and enter the code TOM, T-H-O-M, you get a free footrest. That's xchairtom.com or call 1-844-X-CHAIR. We have one here. We love it. xchairtom.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program.
there's a real interesting conversation that's been started by a guy named Robin Hansen. Robin works at the Mercatus or Mercantor or whatever you call it center at George Mason University, the group that is largely funded by the Koch brothers. He's a libertarian economist, and he raises the question. I'm reading his blog here. His most recent post, this is from yesterday, is titled "A Pullable Thread of the Social Fabric," and he mentions the incels, the involuntarily celibate people, and he compares them to liberals. And he says, while the two groups focus on different axes of inequality, they each organize to induce envy and identity with a deprived status. And what he's talking about with regard to liberals is, hey, there's poor people, and they're not getting any money from our rich people, and therefore we need to take money from rich people in the form of taxes, which Robin Hansen considers violence, as do the Koch brothers, and give that to poor people so that they can have health care and housing and things. So anyhow, back to what he says. They each organize to induce envy and identity with a deprived status, to hint at the possibility of violence. Obviously, the possibility of violence in the case of liberals is, if you don't give us your taxes, we will put you in prison. And to lobby for, quote, redistribution. And then he goes on to say that this is proof that policy can, in fact, influence sexual inequality. He's talking about ancient societies. He says most ancient societies had policies that influenced the redistribution of sex. And this is proof that policy can, in fact, influence sexual inequality. Many people cared about this kind of inequality. You may think you have good moral arguments why such policies are bad, but as with income inequality, you should at least admit that people who feel envious and empowered to push policy may not be much influenced by your moral arguments. His argument specifically, and I've got another one of his blog posts here where he lays it out, is that, basically, unattractive women should be forced to have sex with unattractive men. And one proposed policy. This is not specifically from Robin Hansen. He's blogging about it. This is from Josh Marshall. This anger at women from these involuntarily celibate men who believe they are sexually unappealing, and as they are, and yet nonetheless refuse to have sex with them. The women refuse to have sex with them. One proposed policy is to have the government assign each person a sexual market value. That's what Hansen is talking about here. People can only have sex with people of their own value. And for women, the more partners they have, the further their market value number falls, sort of big data of slut shaming. And the more sexually active a woman becomes, the greater an obligation she incurs to have sex with the least sexually appealing men. And the only way to up her score, in other words, to get out of having sex with these unattractive men, is through exercise to make herself more attractive. So he says alternating bouts of servicing sexually enraged losers and logging nonstop hours at the gym. This is the idea for women, apparently. And Professor Hansen here talking about this at some length. He's got another blog post. It's called Food Versus Sex Charity. And he says, before I go into all this, let's get another libertarian on to see what they think of this. Charles Sauer, libertarian economist, president of the Market Institute, author of the new book, Profit Motive, What Drives the Things We Do. Marketinstitute.org is the website. You can tweet him at Charles Sauer, S-A-U-E-R. Charles, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
So Professor Hansen is arguing that it is possible to have a marketplace for sex, defined by government policy, and doesn't come right out and embrace it, but certainly embraces the concept and says that it has been the case in previous societies. Really?
Well, this is just academic exploration, and the worst part here is the pushback on this has been the left's renunciation or moving away from academic freedom to think. And if you read these blog posts, you won't come away with most of the talking points you just came away with. First off, the title of the blog is called Overcoming Bias. It's an economic blog. And in this case in particular, he's talking about the horrific incident in Toronto where an incel mowed down people on a sidewalk. And this story came to light. And so it's
and in San Bernardino.
I think it's something that he mentions in his blog, but he hadn't heard of this group before. And if you look into it, the incels are the ones that proposed providing some sort of a numeric number for attractiveness. And so he looked into this because if you read his blog, I mean, I think it makes perfect sense that the incels' argument and the liberals' argument for income equality seem to be the same. If a business is successful, a liberal moves them down on their chain and they have to hire more people in the liberal's mind. That's the same argument that incel makes. It's the same argument I've heard you make on here before.
So here's what Robin Hanson says. This is from his blog post. This is his blog titled Food Versus Sex Charity. And he talks about, the problem of a man wanting food because he's hungry versus a man wanting sex because he's horny. And he says, even then, we treat food and sex differently. When we give food aid, we don't just give rice and beans to keep people from starving. We give them enough food to have a moderately tasty diet. He's talking about food stamps. He says, we do nothing remotely similar to sex. For me, the obvious answer is that our concern about inequality is not very general. Compared to inequality in access to foods, humans are just not that concerned about sexual inequality, especially for men, poor men. Presumably for our ancestors, the gene pool of a tribe could benefit from equalizing food in ways that it could not benefit by equalizing sex. Is that the counter argument that he's making here?
No, this is a professor thinking out loud on his blog. You're allowed to push back. And he's also a type of professor that he has books out there. He's a futurist. He thinks in the future. I've actually hosted him at my group Prosperity Caucus several different times, and he's one of the top experts on what's going to happen when AI evolves and becomes more a part of our society. What does that economy look like? Robin Hanser is a thinker. So he hears what's going on in the public. He hears the conversation and he takes that and moves it into an economic argument so that we can actually think about it in some sort of way where we might be able to rationally talk about it.
Okay. He also talks
about inequality. You can't talk about it rationally.
He also talks about, one possible solution to this is something he calls gentle rape. He says, imagine a woman was drugged into unconsciousness and then gently raped so that she suffered no noticeable physical harm nor any memory of the event. And the rapist tried to keep the event secret. He says, most farming societies did this. A colleague of mine says, suggests this is gender bias, pure and simple. Women seem feminist and male chivalrous, but by railing against rape, no one looks good complaining about cuckoldry. He seems to be very upset about women who have affairs. He says, we all know, and I'm quoting him now, we all know that women tend to be more expressive about their complaints. You can't beat them for wailing and gnashing of teeth. Really?
Yep. Do you
endorse that?
If you ask Robin Hanson if he agrees with the way that you just portrayed those comments, he's going to say no. He was talking about what's happened in the past. He was proposing economic ideas versus what's happening. Let's compare this to the way that the liberals are. We have Joy Reid from MSNBC who just claimed a hack in the fact that she didn't say actual hate speech against somebody and ran away with it. Again, this is a professor. I don't agree with the policy solutions he's talking about. I think they're awful.
I don't think he's claiming a hack. So direct question, Charles. What is the libertarian solution to the problem of these unattractive young men who are willing to kill people over their outrage that they're not getting sex?
Psychologists. There's no market solution to this, unless maybe you could allow and legalize prostitution. That might be the libertarian.
But then these guys, I mean, prostitution is widely available. It was certainly available to the San Bernardino shooter and to the Toronto car killer. But they might argue that it is demeaning to them to have to pay for sex, or that they simply can't afford to pay for sex.
But look, let's look at the way that you're framing this question. The way that you're framing this question is ignoring the facts that Robin Hanson is a professor. He's an academic that talks about economic policy. What you're trying to do is shut an academic down from talking about policy.
No, I'm trying to discuss the policy that he brought up. You have not heard me use one adjective to describe Robin Hanson. I'm serious.
You're portraying his thoughts, and you have been saying when you're quoting him, you've been like when you're quoting the incels versus him. But the fact is that an academic should be able to put thoughts out on the internet as long as they don't act on them. He's not up on – Robin Hanson isn't somebody up on Capitol Hill pursuing these policies. He's somebody that is looking
at
it.
No, but we have a very real – we have a very real problem with now we've had two people on this continent – who have murdered a bunch of people, principally women, because they are upset that they are involuntarily celibate, that they are still virgins, and they're no woman has run up to them and say, hey, let's have sex. And they're very upset about this. I guess neither one of us, Charles, have a solution to this problem. Charles Sauer, libertarian economist and president of the Market Institute, his new book, Profit Motive, marketinstitute.org. Thanks, Charles.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back. You got a solution to this problem? Or maybe we just need to, like, take seriously putting these guys in prison.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us, Mimi Kennedy, the actress, activist, writer, board chair with Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org, star of the hit series Mom on CBS, PDAmerica.org, the website. And you can tweet Mimi at Mimi Kennedy LA, as in Los Angeles. Mimi, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be here, Tom. Yeah.
It is always great having you on. So there is a lawsuit going on in Ohio that echoes previous lawsuits in Arizona and Alabama, and I want to get to those too. Tell me what the essence of this is.
The essence of it is to get the Ohio counties that have pictures of the paper ballot to stop destroying those pictures.
Okay, so my understanding of how this works is you fill out the little circles on the paper ballots, and they run them through the scanners, and those scanners then both count who voted for whom, and they take a picture of each one of those ballots, so that the event of because the paper ballots are typically destroyed, do I have this right? And therefore, these ballot images can be used for an audit. Do I have that right?
That's essentially right. In Ohio, when activists won a court case to check out the Kerry Bush paper ballot,
it was a 2004 election.
Out it took so long, the county's 55 of them had destroyed the paper ballot. The ballot images are available right after Election Day.
So this is an audit trail that a lot of us didn't even realize was built into these scanners. And now here we have Alabama. When Alabama and Arizona were sued by Audit USA in 2017, last year, courts ruled in both cases that they had to preserve the ballot images. But then in Alabama, the Republican Secretary of State, John Merrill, went to the Supreme Court and said, we don't want to have to keep the ballot images, and the Supreme Court issued a stay on that lower judge's ruling. Why on earth would Republican election officials not want there to be an audit trail to the voting machines? I don't get this.
Right. Well, that's what's so important about all this. Which finally, I think we've opened up the snake pit. Oh, look, there's snakes here. Let's get them out so they don't bite people and kill them. And some people are going, no, keep them there. One of the best parts of this strategy of getting ballot images, making them preserved, and then having the public record request be the way to access them, to give the public the right to audit their elections, that's according to Doug Kellner, New York State, where they made that the law, is that when you find a reluctant Secretary of State or a reluctant county, well, you know you might have a problem there, and it's time for citizen teams to go in there and start watching how they count the votes and asking questions. In an ideal world, and with the Russian blaming for a hack, because everybody knows cybersecurity is sort of non-existent when stakes are really high. With the Russian fear, almost everybody is on board going, we need to audit our elections. What if they're hacked or manipulated? And John Brakey of Audit Arizona found years ago there are these things called ballot images, and more states have them. Yeah. And they're just not using them. And counties have been destroying them in the dark, and we're shining a light.
Now, when John Kerry lost Ohio by just a little over 100,000 votes, and there were almost 200,000 provisional ballots that had not even been opened or counted, and people went in and said, "Wait a minute, we want to see the ballot images for the non-provisional ballots, for the actual votes that were counted. We'd like to see some proof of this." That election, by the way. The votes were not counted in Ohio. They were counted in Kentucky, was it?
I think so. I don't know all the details of that. Ballot images were not the issue in that Lincoln County case that Cliff Arnebeck was the lawyer for. They wanted to see the paper ballots, as far as I know.
Right.
What happened? And they got the right from the court. But by the time they got the right from the court, out of 88 counties in Ohio, 55 had destroyed their paper ballots.
Right, and nobody knew that they could ask for the ballot images. We didn't even know they existed
exactly.
At that point in time. So where I was going with this, Mimi, is that under the circumstances of the lawsuit in Ohio in 2004, if the state had preserved the physical ballot, and if Cliff and his friends wanted to go in and audit them, they'd have to go in and walk out with a truckload full of paper. And transport that truckload full of paper around the country. You know, if they had, like, say, 1,000 people who said, okay, I'll take, 100 of them and I'll count them and we'll crowdsource this thing, it would have involved massive amounts of shipping and paper moving and logistics. But with ballot images, these are digital files. The state of Ohio could simply say to Cliff Arnebeck, the lawyer who won the case, okay, here are PDFs or digital images. Or JPEGs or whatever format they're in. Here are the digital images for, 1.2 million votes, 1.2 million ballots, and give them to the activists. And the activists could easily develop software, the equivalent of kind of facial recognition, that reads those ballot images so that they could be counted on anybody's laptop. And we could have a real double check of the election in 24 hours, presumably. And this could be done anywhere in the country. Why are we not doing this?
Well, there's two reasons. One, nobody knew there were ballot images, and I don't think 04 in Ohio, the equipment made ballot images. Maybe the DF-200 did. But the other reason is that people don't want the public verifying their elections. But the public has woken up and goes, yes, we want to.
You mean Republicans don't want the public verifying their elections?
Well, some Republicans are a little worried about hackability and manipulation, and I like to think that might be because they know something about what operatives have been doing on their side for a while. And I'm not saying the Democrats have never manipulated an election either, but I am saying that it's a nonpartisan effort at this point, and I think Democrats should be entirely behind it and all progressives because it's for the voters. It's for the public. This is verifiability for 2018, for sure. And at Audit Arizona, there's a list of the states and the counties that have this equipment. And if you see your county there, go in and say, we want to preserve the ballot images. John Brakey has done this in Arizona. It's very expensive, but he got on it early. Arizona, Alabama, I think that's one reason Chuck Jones might have won. They scared the bejesus out of those people. And those county election officials might have been preserving ballot images, even though their Secretary of State didn't want them to. And Ohio. Now, Ohio in 2016, Patrakis found them turning off the printer that stamped the paper ballots with the same identifying number as the ballot in the chat. So there's a lot of ways, whack-a-mole, that people have fought having these ballot images there as an audit trail and a public verification. But they're now getting the court to say, absolutely, these are election records. Absolutely, you can't destroy them. Secretary of State, it's on you. You tell your counties, don't destroy these things.
Right.
New York State has it locked up. They did it. And Doug Kellner has an interesting YouTube explanation where he goes, paper, voter verified paper audit trail is something we've been calling for a long time. More and more states have it, but it doesn't mean anything unless you do an audit. And
right.
It's been so impossible to get your hands on the paper ballots. Your scenario where the trucks go everywhere. You couldn't take a paper ballot out of the election office. They have to be counted there by staff. And the county goes, that'll be $2 million. But with the paper ballot images, you can do what you described.
Right.
And that's why.
So has this lawsuit against Ohio been adjudicated, or is it just starting? And what is John Kasich's position on this? He's positioning himself to run for president in 2020. He's the governor of Ohio. Is he gung-ho for, election transparency, or is he one of the Republicans who doesn't want us to be able to see how we voted?
Crickets
out of John Kasich, okay.
Okay. Yeah. This has been a grassroots action, and what's nice is we're not hearing crickets from the judges in the court.
Yeah. Well, that's a good thing.
So it'll filter up.
That's a very good thing. Congressman
Indeed. Mimi Kennedy, actor, activist, writer, board chair at Progressive Democrats of America, the website pdamerica.org. She's the star of the hit series Mom on CBS. And you can tweet her at Mimi Kennedy, L.A. And of course, at PD America. Mimi, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.
Always great talking with you. We'll be right back. It's Talk Media for the sane among us, speaking the truth the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. Gordon in Williamsport, Ohio. Hey, Gordon, what's on your mind?
Hey, how you doing? Good. Hey, your presentation of corrections work is not far off. I've been in corrections for 25 years. I'm retired now. I've been retired for about 10 years. But years ago, the mailroom come up with a company that you had to – the family had to send to the money to buy a TV, a book, or anything, and then they went through it, and it was like clear plastic as far as the TV to see if there's any contraband coming in.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the other aspect of it. When Taft was in there, he authorized certain companies to come in from out of the state to put plumbing in these correction facilities. And you could not go out to Lowe's to buy a turn-on, turn-off faucet. Mm-hmm. You had to go through their company.
Mm.
And the prices were outrageous.
Yeah. So basically, it was a government contractor who had the sweetheart deal that anything that goes into a prison has to go through them first, and they get to mark it up.
Bingo.
Yeah.
You paid into a certain book that all the business operations through the state of Ohio, Forest Corrections, paid into, and they would underbid everybody else.
Amazing.
And Gordon, they got it.
Gordon, as a former corrections officer, I'm wondering if you could comment on the charge that has been made, that I made in the last segment, that a lot of the drugs in our prisons are brought into our prisons by corrections officers.
Bingo. That's another. That yes, you are correct on that. Mm. And visitors.
And visitors.
They don't have the means. They don't have, yeah, the visitors. They don't have the means of, and I've got certificates to show that I've caught certain things. So mm-hmm. I've got certificates. I got in writing. They come in with things. The saying around prisons in the state of Ohio is if you lose the drugs to keep the inmates calm and then everything, we lose control of the prison. And the reason why is you got 180 officers working a shift with about 3,500 inmates.
So it actually works to the benefit of the corrections officers if your more violent inmates are sitting back in their cells stoned on heroin than if they're sober and willing to start a fight.
Yes.
That's bizarre.
Leave me alone. Leave me alone. I'm in my corner. I'm not going to start no fight. I'm not going to cause no problem. You do your 8 hours, punch out, and leave.
Yeah.
And if you cause problems, you're going to be taken off the shift, and you're going to be targeted.
Amazing. Amazing. Gordon, thank you for sharing that perspective, the perspective of a former corrections officer with us. I appreciate it. You speak with an authority.
Anything to do with state of Ohio and corrections, I'll call you.
Okay, Gordon, thank you very much. You speak with an authority that the rest of us lack. I appreciate it. Julie in Costa Mesa, California. Hey, Julie, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I'm wondering, I worked in the area of grants for quite a while at the University of California here, and there was a point where the National Science Foundation started introducing the STEM programs. Have you heard of those?
Yeah. Science, technology, math, engineering and math. Is that STEM?
Right.
Yeah.
Now, all of the sciences are supposed to be included under the S, including physical, natural, and social sciences.
Mm-hmm.
But what you see going on everywhere is the systematic, what I call the systematic elimination of the social sciences when they offer these programs. And yet, when Congress created the NSF as the kind of official research organ of the U.S.,
the National Science Foundation,
deliberately the social sciences. And it's like we're creating like a generation or two of people who aren't going to be savvy and literate in social sciences, and in the meantime, we, the people, are being run over roughshod, and, you know, we're being ignored economically and sociologically and anthropologically, destroying the waters sacred to the Indians, and the people aren't educated to know even what's happening.
Yeah, yeah, and it's a crime. You're absolutely right. Julie, thank you for sharing that. Robin in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Robin, what's on your mind?
I'm so grateful to get the call through. I just wanted to know if you could put a word in to some of the Democrats in their push for 2018, those particular elections, that we need to talk about policy, that it's okay to, you know, dish Trump and everything. I'm all for that because of the things he's done personally. But I think that his policies are what's important. He is, and they're kind of going under the radar. And I really, really, really wish that, because a lot of Democrats, progressive Democrats, want the Democrats to talk about that, to push that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree, Robin, and there's a broad consensus in the Democratic Party around that. But well, I'll continue pushing it. Robin, thanks for listening to 1350 AM in Albuquerque. Harrison, listening on KBCS in Seattle, you have the last minute.
Hey, appreciate it, Tom. Thank you. Hey, the Korean unification, I'm curious what you think as far as a unified Korea. To me seems like just an incredibly potent economic force. And to what extent would the United States not view that as a positive development?
I doubt that you're going to see Korean unification. I think what you're going to see is a ratcheting down of the tensions and North Korea continuing as basically a crypto-fascist state and South Korea continuing as they are. But if there was unification, there'd be a massive supply of very cheap labor, which would give a huge infusion, a huge boost, I think, over the short term anyway, to South Korea's economy, or at least their competitiveness in the world. To the extent that, you know, we consider countries that have cheap labor to be competitive. But like I said, I think it's remote. Harrison, interesting question, though. You're thinking. I like it. Thanks so much for the call. We'll be back tomorrow. In the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It doesn't work if we don't get involved. You, your friends, your family, your neighbors, your coworkers, get out there, get active. Wake some people up. Tell them about progressive media. Tell them about this show. Get out there, get active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.